Good afternoon, Detroit. I'm Kelly Cobb.
And I'm Caitlin Buss.
It's officially afternoon. It's 12 o'clock. Caitlin, I was at the Republican convention, and I got to hear that Perry Johnson song that if you just tuned in, you didn't hear it. But if you were listening, you heard Perry Johnson's country song. And I got to tell you, at the convention, like, everybody was laughing about it, like, for and against. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, it's been effective, I think.
Yeah, it's a creative strategy.
47-47. I mean, the great thing about all of these political ploys is not all of them stick, but when they do stick, they can really help you quickly.
Yeah, they can. I don't know. I want to see that done live. That's what I'm looking for. I don't know if that'll happen on the campaign trail, but
yeah, I wonder who's saying that for him.
I don't know. Anyway, but speaking of convention, so that was the Republican.
It was Lee Greenwood. I don't know.
If it was Lee Greenwood, that'd be an impressive play. Lee Greenwood at the Republican convention in Milwaukee, when was that, 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
That like took the whole entire convention like away. Everyone's like, that's actually Lee Greenwood. It was pretty cool.
He's busy selling Bibles.
Is he?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's important work too.
Yeah.
So, speaking of conventions, the Republican convention was a while ago, but the Democrats just had their convention over the past weekend. And by all accounts, if you were there or not, or you were just happened to find yourself on X or any other platform looking at videos, it seemed like a pretty raucous time. A lot of yelling, a lot of shouting.
Yeah.
Some inappropriate and vulgar language, which we are not going to repeat.
Yeah.
But it was, by all accounts, from what I saw at least, quite the event.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's, a couple of things here. So looking back at both conventions now, thankfully they're both over for Republicans and Democrats. And now we can move to where most of the voting public tunes into the election anyway, so we can get past everything that's happened. But there's a couple of things going on here. I think the Democratic convention, there were certainly some concerning things. I think you see in the results how far left Democratic candidates that are actually winning in primaries and becoming the candidates in a lot of places, like New York City, and he became the mayor. How far left that really has gone. And you saw that in the results. You also have this kind of anti-Semitic, very, you know, certainly anti-war, if you don't want to go that far, but, you know, anti what's going on in the Middle East element going on, and some very, you know, like you said, things that we won't repeat about, you know, Jewish candidates and attendees, which is, you know, beyond the pale. But then at the same time, you have 7,000 people there.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know enough about the ins and outs. You know more about that, how conventions come together and then, you know, the mechanism for getting people there and all of the delegate process. But just at a cursory glance, it would seem that momentum is on the Democrat side, because I was at least Friday night of the Republican one, and then you could not, I don't even know if 2,000 people were there.
Yeah.
And again, there's reasons for that and the party workings and everything. But I do think there's concerning stuff going on for Democrats, and they all see that. What I think they have going into this midterm is certainly enthusiasm and momentum.
Yeah. And that is true. And it's the angle that the Democrats are leaning in on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're trying to portray, that we're the big tent party. We had people from, you know, mm-hmm. I saw one quote, black, white, Arab, Jewish, you name it. We represented all the people in Metro Detroit and the entire state of mm-hmm. Michigan diversely. And there were tons of people there, and it was wonderful. It's just that the videos on the ground really, really look different than that. And some of the you mentioned the progressive.
Yeah, I mean, right. They're repeating. Sorry to cut you off.
No.
They're repeating the mistake that Republicans made for, you know, not this past convention. I mean, what did we say? We said finally the Republicans were boring in their convention because, you know, they didn't. I don't think they had quite the behavior that we saw at the Democratic one still.
No.
But sharp division, you know, some shouting and chaos that didn't go well for them for a number of cycles.
Yeah. And the Republicans picked, you know, for AG and Secretary of State, they picked the more moderate of the candidates. It was like the normal GOP from, you know, years ago was back, but with the current sort of political mindset at the same time. the Democrats went very progressive. I mean, Ellie Savitt, for Attorney General, who's currently the prosecutor of Washtenaw County, that was a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. He was up against, he's a progressive, Washtenaw. He was up against Karen McDonnell, who tried the Oxford shooting case and had built a reputation on that. She's also the sister of, you know, her sister's in Congress. So so she's got a lot of name bona fides. She's got a lot of, you know, political sort of wind at her back from what she accomplished. And then at the same time you had that going on, you had Haley Stevens running for Senate, Representative Stevens getting booed and shouted down. And then you had the progressives being supported in Mallory McMorrow and Abdel El-Sayed.
Yeah, Haley Stevens getting shouted down was pretty remarkable, especially because she's a sitting congresswoman.
Yeah.
So that was, you don't often see that. And it was funny, she could not put out video after that. I mean, there was just no video to put out. And just a personally hard experience. I was feeling bad for the volunteers behind her because it's hard to have 7,000 people booing you in one room. But, you know, that shows where they want these candidates to be. And Republicans know all too well that how hard it is to satisfy the more extreme ends of your base, make it through a primary, transition to someone who's appealing in the general election. So, yeah, Democrats have made it, from my perspective, and we're going to hear more about this from someone who was there and knows a lot about this, they've made it harder for themselves.
Yeah, they have. And if you look at the U of M region case, it's the one where it's a lower ballot issue, it's a lower ballot race. But all the candidates for, you know, trustees at the universities and stuff, those were all incumbents and they slid through, except for Jordan Acker got thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is, you know, there was sort of an Arab versus Jewish component to that race. And at the same time, neither of them came with a clean slate.
Yeah.
The progressive who beat him has a track record of praising Hezbollah, mm-hmm. which is a designated terrorist organization. And Jordan Acker, just before this happened, had text messages leaked of him that were, you know, wildly inappropriate that he had sent to people.
Yeah.
So both of those candidates have baggage now, but the progressive won.
I think Acker, through his lawyer, has not really, I don't know if he's accepted that those were from him or not, but I think this is a hard one because it both has the narrative that you're talking about, which is the anti-Semitism, you know, pro-Palestine angle, which can be interpreted many different ways. But at the end of the day, if people think that you're just kind of a jerk and those text messages, you know, were jerky, if they are true or not, once that perception is out there, a lot of the policy doesn't matter. So it's hard to know in that case, you know, what was the immediate impact. But
pretty
shocking result.
Yeah. Well, stick around. We're going to keep talking about the convention with Adrian Hemman. He's with Grassroots Midwest and a longtime Democratic insider and campaign strategist to get his take. Stick around. You're listening to Focus with Paul W. Welcome back to Focus with Paul W. Smith. I'm Kelly Cobb and joined by Caitlin Buss. And we've been talking about the convention, the Democratic convention, over the weekend, and want to continue that conversation with somebody who probably knows better than anybody else. And that's Adrian Hemman. He's the CEO of Grassroots Midwest. He's a campaign strategist and has worked in Democratic policy and political circles for many years. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on. So Caitlin and I kind of already hashed out our opinions on the matter. I want to know yours. I mean, how do you feel that this convention went? It seemed to go very progressive. Either they stuck with the incumbent or they shifted into the progressive lane pretty strongly.
I think that's right. You know, there are a lot of new people that showed up at convention this year who were recruited by some of the more progressive candidates. And some of the more moderate candidates that were, you know, facing the convention floor got out organized by some of the progressives. So that's a big feat for some of the progressive candidates. It's an open question, you know, what penalty Democrats will pay in terms of their electoral chances in some of these races in the fall. The environment may be bad enough for Republicans that it won't matter, but to the extent that who got nominated this weekend matters. It's probably not in Democrats' favor in terms of some of these more progressive candidates that are a little bit to the left of the median voter.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, because we were saying in this segment before this, just Republicans have obviously gone through this for, I don't know, much of the past decade. I would say this last convention was their first kind of better one recently.
Normal one.
Yeah. So do you think there's an appetite for restructuring the primary process after this, or do you ever see that changing?
Well, I certainly hope so. The way that we select these partisan nominees for those three university boards and for attorney general and for secretary of state is an abomination, right? The fact that the taxpayers are subsidizing this by blessing these folks with ballot access for no other reason than they were able to impress the most partisan people in our state, Democrat or Republican, really offends the sensibilities of most Michiganders when they learn about it. We're long overdue for reforming that process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great point. I wonder, you know, when you look at the outcome of this, you know, knowing that the grassroots really, really drives it home at both the Republican and Democratic conventions, who do you think won in this? And there's probably multiple winners, but who, you know, who's the big one that comes out on top in this one?
You mean between the two parties?
No, just in the Democratic convention. Like, who comes out on top? What's your most surprising result out of this?
I mean, biggest winner of the Democratic convention this weekend was Doug Lloyd, the Republican nominee for attorney general.
There you go. And why? Explain why, Adrian. Explain why the Republican wins out of the Democratic convention.
So most of these down ballot races, normal people who vote, i.e. most people, they're voting based on partisanship, right? There's a reason why we use things like the university boards as a measure of partisanship. Attorney general is one of those down ballot races where you can get people to take a walk from their party in either direction, right? And typically Michiganders are going to want to vote for the most moderate candidate who is the most focused on actual law enforcement and consumer protection issues. It's pretty easy to portray the most progressive prosecutor in our state as being to the left of the median voter. And I expect that that's what the Michigan Republican Party is going to attempt to do in that race. Democrats made that somewhat easier by nominating the most progressive prosecutor in the state.
Yeah. And Republicans, they didn't nominate the guy who ran on, you know, having defended the, you know, the people who went and what did they do? The ballot signature or the ballots for Donald Trump, you know, and whether they violated campaign law and everything. They voted for the guy who's just kind of a quiet prosecutor and a really kind of centrist prosecutor who just focuses on the rule of law. I've talked to Doug Lloyd. He's a very toned down guy, which is interesting. The other race I thought, you know, made kind of a splash, of course, was the U of M Regent race where Amir Makhled won against Jordan Acker, who's the incumbent. Neither of them walked in with a clean record, right, Adrian? And at the same time, you had a lot of backlash against Acker, and they didn't release the vote totals, but from what I understand, it was very clear from the beginning that Amir was going to carry the day.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I think that this is the primary example of progressives simply out-organizing some of the more mainline establishment forces in the Democratic Party. You know, there were, you know, the graduate student unit union at the University of Michigan did a lot of organizing work with other graduate students in other parts of the state. And that's a lot of who you saw on the convention floor. That looks real different from what a primary electorate looks like statewide in Michigan. The median Dem primary voter is a black woman who's in a church pew every Sunday. That's not what that convention floor looked like. And that's why Amir Makhled won.
Yeah. You alluded to this earlier. I mean, so I think, you know, a lot of Democrats maybe disagree, but whatever the outcome is, what it is. Do you think that Republicans are in a, what position are Republicans in up against even that poor Democratic slate? Do you think they're in a bad enough position for it not to matter?
Yes. the fact is that
I was trying to avoid it being that easy.
Well, no, most voters are going to base their vote on the same thing that they always do historically, right? Which is, what does their personal economic position look like? What does the economic position of their friends, neighbors, and family members look like? And right now, most Americans think that looks bad, including most Michiganders. It's certainly possible to swim against that tide. We've seen it before in prior elections, but it is important to recognize that if current economic conditions persist through the election, Republicans will be swimming against that tide.
Yeah, I mean, the number one determinant of elections is presidential approval. It's like statistically the most determinant outcome, at least for congressional districts. But that tends to trickle all the way down, even in a year where, especially, I should say, in a year where the president's not on the ballot in a midterm. And so you could have this sort of progressive slate. Caitlin and I were talking about this the other night, this sort of frustration that the average voter feels about the economy and how some of these voters really, you know, they went from, say, Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump, and now they might swing back and support these progressive candidates that the Democrats have nominated. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our politics these days are determined, especially our electoral politics, are determined by who are people that don't pay attention to politics every day most angry at. And it's typically going to be whoever has the most power in the national government, because that's the level of politics that people are paying attention to. And right now, Republicans control all the levers of the national government. And so people who don't pay very much attention to politics, if they're mad about the economy, they're mad at Republicans because that's who's in charge.
Yeah, I think Michigan voters, I mean, I tend to hope that they focus more on issues closer to home. But I think there is so much that goes into what people actually decide to do when they're in that ballot box. And I know myself, I've made, you know, a decision that I thought I was going to make, and then when I was in there, I made a different one. So you just never know what messaging might get through. But that's what you are an expert in and spend your time doing. So we really appreciate you spending the time with us and going through this past convention.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Adrian. It'll be fascinating to see how this plays out now that you have sort of the tables turned and the Republicans have more of the moderate candidates nominated. You have the Democrats nominating more of the progressives. It's definitely, like you said, a shift from the past few years. So it'll be fascinating.
Yep.
We'll be right back after a brief break with Focus with Paul W. Smith. Stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Caitlin Buss. Thanks for hanging with us here this afternoon while we try and fill Paul W. Smith's shoes. Good to be with my husband, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for being with us.
So we've been a little in the weeds on politics. We're gonna hang out there for a little bit longer, but we have some
drag you through the
exciting,
mud more.
I don't know how exciting it is. We have some interesting topics coming up.
Yeah.
But someone we both know and like here joining us is Tim Golding. He's the state director of Americans for Prosperity in Michigan. And that group does a ton of great work. They do a lot of great policy work, advancing kind of the principles of freedom and prosperity. But they have been focused recently on the 35th Senate District, where there's a special election coming up on May 5th. Tim, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. How are you guys doing today?
We're good.
Good, thanks.
So tell us about this election. I know on the editorial page of the news, we had to actually write several editorials about this. I think maybe even four, just to get this election actually called for. But now it's coming up. So tell us about your work there and what you all have been advocating for.
Yeah, we've supported Jason Tunney in that race. It's been vacant now for over 400 days because the governor was, for whatever reason, did not call the special election. But yeah, May 5th is the day. It's a huge race. Kind of the balance of the Senate hangs on that. And Jason Tunney's a former business owner, lawyer, great candidate, conservative policy champion. We think he'll be when he gets to Lansing. And we've been working with our grassroots activists in that district to canvass neighborhoods. We send out mail pieces. We do digital advertising and stuff like that, all in the attempt to try to get him elected.
How did the residents feel there? I mean, did you get any sense of their frustration without representation for so long?
Yeah, that was a big deal. The people we talked to at the doors, and again, we talk to people all over the state every day, but in that district, they were perturbed that they have had basically taxation without representation for over 400 days now. And that was a point of contention with them. And hopefully that'll carry through with excitement and push Jason over the victory line here on May 5th.
Right.
We need to turn out, and that's what we've been focusing on, is turning out the conservative voters who typically stay home in special elections, but we're seeing an uptick in that. So hopefully that'll be enough to carry him over the finish line.
Yeah, a lot of people coming out of that primary, there was a huge number of people that voted in the Democratic primary on that side, and not as many on the Republican side. A lot of people took that as, hey, there's momentum. The Democrats got momentum in this race, but do you see, have you seen any polling? Is it closing at all? Are you feeling anything from the ground? It's a very tight district as it is. And I know I read recently that Cheddar Green, the Democrats, dropping a lot of money on ads in that race in the final days here. I have read that Jason Tunney has not done that yet. I'm curious, how you think this is going to, has this tightened and what the outcome, is it just going to be like flip a coin at the end of the day?
To be honest, somebody spent over $1 million on Cheddar Green's television ads over the course of this special, and Tunney's camp did not spend that kind of money. It was tighter. It actually has opened up a little bit. I think the conflict in Iran has not helped any conservative candidate across the state. But typically, as you know, the Democrats do turn out in bigger numbers in these special elections. I think we're going to close the gap a little bit. It's going to be tough, no doubt about it. But, one of the reasons we did get in early was looking at the special, but also looking forward into November. And hopefully, well, it will tighten up then because more conservatives vote in those November elections. So I'm still relatively confident he can win on the 5th. I'm still planning on that. But if he doesn't, we're ready to get back in the fight for the November election, because that is when we have our best turnout. That's when there's the most engagement, the most excitement around these elections.
Yeah.
So there is a lot at play here. But if you do look at the numbers, the Democrats turn out in much higher numbers in these races. And that's across the country as well, not just in Michigan.
And tell us what you are working on looking at November. I mean, is it, are you looking at the legislature, congressional races, all of the above?
Well, yeah, so AFP, America's Prosperity, that's one thing I love about my job. We get to work at the state and the federal level. So roughly at this point, our AFP action has endorsed Mike Rogers for the Senate. We've endorsed Tom Barrett in the Congress. Mm-hmm. We'll probably get involved in one or two more congressional races. But then in the state, we're going to be involved in the governor's race. We're going to be involved in the state Senate and the state House. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think it's going to be a good election year for us. I think there's things trending in the right way. We've got some great candidates. So we get to be involved in all that. But then we're also going to be involved in the policy side of stuff here at the state and the federal level as well. So it's fun. We get to put our feet into all those different rings.
Do you think people have an appreciation for how big of an election this is in Michigan, just how many races are up and how much of a trajectory setting moment it's going to be? What do you think turnout will look like in general?
Yeah, I mean, being a midterm election, and it is a monumental election, honestly, because they say Trump's not on the ballot. But if things go sideways in Congress, then it's going to be impeachment, and President Trump won't be able to get his agenda passed.
Yeah,
part of our job in building communities and working across the state is to drive that excitement, drive that awareness that there is a lot at stake, everything from the governor's race, the secretary of state, attorney general, all of those things. And if you look at some of the people that are being put forward on the other side of the aisle, there's some pretty progressive candidates that, quite frankly, I don't think have Michigan's best interest in heart. And what we will continue to do throughout the year while we're working on policy, while we're working on getting these people elected, is driving that excitement, hopefully, and creating the narrative and telling people what's at stake all across the state. So we do have a tremendous turnout. I don't think the Dems have any big ballot initiatives, hopefully, that are going to be on that will drive turnout like we've seen in previous cycles. So that helps.
Interesting to see a lot of those ballot measures just not collect enough signatures. Almost all of them have effectively failed. Tim, I'm wondering this year is an election year. You don't typically see much action policy-wise in an election year. We got about a minute left. I'm curious if you think anything big is going to get through the legislature. You know, property tax reform, for example, was Speaker Hall's, you know, big thing maybe a month or two ago. Do you think they actually get something done like that this year?
Based on some conversations I had today, I do think they get some big things done. And I think one of the big things is some zoning reform for housing so we can start creating some abundant housing in the state. So I do think things are going to move and looking forward to it.
That's interesting. Yeah, the Mackinac Center's worked hard on that one, too. I know you guys at AFP have as well. And yeah, and it's bipartisan, which is rare.
We need it.
Yeah, we do need it. We got to bring housing prices down. And bipartisan stuff, maybe that slides through. Tim Golding, AFP's state director, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you. Talk and we'll be back with more Focus with Paul W. Smith in just a second. Welcome back to Focus with Paul W. Smith. I'm Kelly Cobb.
And I'm Caitlin Buss.
And we didn't really talk about this before, but Caitlin and I are married. So a lot of the conversation you're listening to is what we talk about between, like, I don't know, when our kids go to bed. So 8:30, 9 o'clock until, I don't know, 11.
Or what I text you
or when
throughout
you text
the day.
Me constantly, all day long.
When you're sitting downstairs.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, our offices are above one another. Different floors, but the same home. We've been talking a lot about politics. It's getting, I want to move on.
Yeah,
I went to fill up my gas tank yesterday and it was on E. I spent for the first time in a very long time, I spent about $110, over $100.
Yeah.
And I was pretty mad about it. I'm not going to lie. I never really look at how much gas costs. It's like, you got to fill your tank. You got to fill your tank. $110 jumped out at me. And at the same time, I know that I'm not alone in that. Consumer sentiment in America is plummeted, and all these promises that we've been given by politicians, frankly, of both parties, that the economy is going to turn around and everything here in Michigan, whether it's Democrats or nationally, Donald Trump, they're just not materializing. And here to help us parse through. Well, what?
Yeah, no, I mean, we live this daily.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody lives it daily. We have four kids, and so life is super expensive. And I mean, I think we're pretty good about it, but it's hard to imagine. Well, it's certainly hard to imagine more kids than us, people with more kids than us, but even fewer. I mean, my spending habits have changed so much in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so drastically different from how we grew up and how people before us grew up. I think like you were saying, it goes really beyond party. This is a societal shift that people are feeling, and that will eventually have huge political repercussions. It already kind of has. But for any moms out there, I see you and I feel you.
Yeah. And for example, before and after our four children, before I purchased approximately zero raspberries. And today I think we purchase maybe 8 to 10 containers per week.
It's just a given. If you go to a store and they have fruit, you will buy some.
Yes. Yeah, that's the life with children. So. We're pleased to welcome Vance Ginn. He's the head of Ginn Economic Consulting, but also brilliant guy, former chief economist at the White House Office of Management and Budget under Trump's first term. Vance, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
No, for sure. So there's this gap, I feel like, it's like people are talking out of two different worlds here. I'm looking at a chart, and it's radio, and so this is boring, but Wall Street, the S&P, is at an all-time high, and consumer sentiment in America out of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey is at an all-time low, record spread between the two for the first time ever. Sometimes you hear politicians
say—
Well,
what did I say the other day? And maybe this isn't true, but the last time that happened—
Yeah, well, you say
the
it.
The guillotine was invented.
All right, Vance. You got something more hopeful than that? What's going on here?
Oh, man. Y'all are bringing up some good points there. And I think what we're seeing, right, is that Wall Street is doing well while Main Street is floundering, is having a tough time. I mean, 2025, what I call it, was the year of uncertainty. The on-again, off-again tariffs, and just a lot of changes that were happening across the economy. And in 2026, I think the word is affordability. I mean, we're hearing it all the time. And it really is something that has continued to hit us hard of the last 4, 5, 6 years, as we've seen inflation skyrocket. Miro's up 9% in 2022, but then it's kept going up. I mean, those price levels just kept skyrocketing, and wages and earnings haven't been able to keep up. And I think that's really what many people are feeling, that y'all were expressing just a minute ago. And now we've had all these geopolitical concerns this year as well, with Iran and different things happening, that's driven up the price of oil and therefore the price of gas. And it just seems like families can't keep up. I've got three young kids of my own, so I definitely know what y'all are talking about. And it's just really hard to get by.
Yeah. What do you think the impact is going to be kind of immediately of that? I mean, I don't foresee this getting better in the next 6 months enough to move anyone's opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing will be, as y'all have been talking about, the political ramifications. I mean, I think what we've seen already is that this has been a tough time for Republicans, because for a while they could just blame the Democrats and say, well, it's their fault that prices are so high. But now the Republicans have been in charge for a while and things aren't improving. And in fact, in some cases, it's getting worse. And I think this really comes down to the case on policy, is that we need less government spending. We've got to stop these massive federal deficits. And the Federal Reserve, the central bank, has got to stop printing so much money. And until that happens, I don't see any way out of this affordability crisis.
Yeah, and my concern here is that, you know, we talked in a prior segment about how people are just looking for the person who's going to say, I'm going to make this more affordable and bring something different to the table. Hmm. Republicans in power, you know, they're not doing the job. So now we're going to swing to the other end and we're going to get more progressive policies out of it. You know, there are a lot of voters that have shifted between Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump to whoever the next person might be that's a progressive. Do you think we could swing in a bad policy direction because we aren't solving the problems today?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, what I've seen is kind of this populism, right? And as we've all seen, has really taken hold of our public policy. And even though it may be quote unquote popular, it doesn't mean that it's sound economics. It doesn't mean that it's sound policy. And too often what I see is that the government's trying to come in and put in price controls and other things to solve a problem that was created by government. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to do that. In fact, what it does is it exacerbates the problem when you add more government to the mix. What we really need is less government. Let's get government out of the way when it comes to housing. Let's get government out of the way when it comes to oil and gas and electricity. And I think the more we do of that, the better off we're going to be in a quicker time period to getting more affordable things across the economy.
Yeah, I think something you mentioned that I feel like keeps being underreported, because whenever I see it, I'm like, is that really true? But the printing money aspect, I mean, this is just, I don't know how many big, you know, instances of that have happened in the Trump second term. I don't know really the history, honestly, but every time I see it, I'm like, no, it's true.
Yeah. Well, no, that's exactly right. I mean, just to put it short and quick, is that Milton Friedman said, my favorite economist, he said that inflation is you have too much money chasing too few goods. So you're looking at supply and demand. And what we've seen historically is that when the Federal Reserve buys treasury debt, they buy the government's debt, and then they print more money. Well, now there's more money in circulation chasing the same number of goods and services. So what happens? Prices go up. Yeah. And that's exactly what we're seeing again today. Starting in December of 2025, the Federal Reserve started printing more money, meaning that they increased their balance sheet. And I don't want to get too nerdy in all this for your audience, but in general, that is contributing to this higher levels of inflation that we're feeling all around us. And until that stops, we're going to have affordability problems continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it balloons with people's personal spending habits too, credit and all of that, and a lack of understanding how if the money's real or not.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Vance Ginn, Economic Consulting, former chief economist at the White House Office of Management and Budget. Thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
And he's so right. We've talked about this a lot. If we don't get it under control, we're going to have wild swings between two completely different solution
ideas. Because
it
doesn't seem, I don't know.
I know. All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a brief break.
Hey, thanks for being with us this afternoon. This is Caitlin Buss, me and my husband, Kelly Cobb. Say hi.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining.
guest hosting Paul's show. We're happy to be here. Hope he's having a great time. We thought it'd be fun to play. Well, I really actually don't like games that much, but this is something we spend a lot of time doing, which is you talk about something in the news and then see what I think about it.
Yes. I gotta be honest,
I do both at work and at home.
Yeah, I'm saying too much here, but I was thinking about it. Like, this sounds like probably something in everybody's relationship or marriage. Like, the man is going to bring some facts to the table, and the woman has an opinion about it. And we always have fun when we talk about things.
I often bring facts. I'm capable of doing that.
Your opinions are always grounded in facts, honey. Of course they are. So I had some. Well, I have one for you that I think that you'll love. Today, on this day. This is the day that John Adams was sworn in as Vice President of the United States under George Washington.
Wow.
And I know how much you love John Adams, so today's an anniversary.
I also love George Washington. So,
I know you do. Yeah.
Was he sworn in today as well?
No.
Oh.
Just John Adams. But anyway, there's a fun fact for you. Okay, so
maybe it's something in the travel logistics back then. They didn't.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
Or they did president and I don't know. It all happened so fast at the founding of the country. So this is where I can't provide more facts, but Caitlin can. This is a story that I thought was fascinating because it's really just entertaining. Caitlin and I took our kids and we went up north to the UP last year. And while we were there, there's a lot of bears in the UP. There's a lot of bears. And we went to this bear ranch.
Yeah.
And
Which
it was a lot
awesome.
Of
awesome.
It was very cool. Like, you can just go watch bears, just whatever.
Throw apples at them and feed them.
Right. So
it was pretty cool.
It's in the middle of nowhere. So we've been around bears enough to know what bears are like, but I don't think it takes much to do so. But I found this story yesterday in California. Three people got caught in an insurance scam. They dressed up in a bear costume and shredded apart. So, you know, like when you're grilling, they have those like kind of they look like brass knuckles, but they have claws on them. You can pry the meat apart. So they shredded apart the inside of a Rolls Royce and two Mercedes to try and collect over $150,000 from insurance companies. So the insurance companies come in,
what?
And they're like, well, is there footage of this? They found footage of somebody doing it in a bear costume,
wow.
In a full bear costume.
That is creative.
It's very creative. So they brought in like a specialist, and the specialist just took one look at the video camera footage and was like, that's clearly not a bear. It's a person. And so these three people are being charged with insurance fraud. It's just like at least, you know, try to pick something that like could potentially.
So much work.
I know. And they bought these cars. They drive them up into the mountains to do it so that they can claim it's a bear. But the funniest part
then
was.
How'd they have a video?
They recorded it themselves to try to prove that it was a bear when it was clearly a person in a bear costume holding grilling tools in their hands.
I don't know. I'm sure there's some saying about a person like that.
I think there
too
is.
Too clever for their own idiocy or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then we also encountered a bear footprint on that trip.
We did very quickly.
A fresh bear footprint.
Yeah, there are bears everywhere.
And I was genuinely scared because we were not ready to take on a bear at that moment.
Yes, we weren't.
So it was, and then the kids got scared because, of course, I got scared.
Yeah, but we were fine. We were fine. But something that actually is somewhat scary as parents is in nature is an uptick in Lyme disease being reported. So tick populations are exploding in the state of Michigan. There have been more than 2,000 cases of Lyme disease in Michigan over the past couple of years now. And the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services warning people about a jump in Lyme disease cases. I feel like when I was a kid, this was not an issue. And now every summer I'm looking at it like we have to like scan our kids when they get inside. They're always playing out in the grass in the woods.
It's way worse than it used to be. I'm not sure all the reasons for that. If it's just that the population has grown or if it's not as cold here in the winters or what exactly. But it just seemed like we have more dangerous bugs in the summer than before.
Yeah, it used to be like mosquitoes when I was a kid. I don't know what
happened. Yeah, and even this morning there was a rather active text chain of moms discussing potential ticks in the wooded areas that our kids play in. And then I realized that our kids went in that area last night and we did not make them boil themselves in hot water afterwards. So
we're just hoping
for the best. But yeah, no, it's very important that you check them. We've gotten better about it, but it's also a bummer because in Michigan, once it finally gets nice out, it's like, let me go run through the grass and the trees.
Yeah.
And now we have this concern. But I think if you check, that's pretty much the best safeguard against it.
All right. That's our warning, everyone. Check for ticks. One last thing on the nature stuff. You flagged this video yesterday. In Petoskey, devastating rainfall, you know, a lot of flooding going up and in Charlevoix area around Mullet, Burt Lake, and so on. But one silver lining that came out of it was a 14-year-old kid got his first catch of the season when he stepped out of the vehicle he's in and grabbed a full-on pike that was swimming around in the road that was, I mean, you look at the video, it's probably only 6 inches to a foot deep at most. And he just reached down and he grabs this fish with his bare hands. And so 14-year-old kid makes his first catch of the year. I know.
That was so cool.
It's awesome.
He had no fear about it either.
No, he was happy. And that thing is huge. It's like probably 2 feet long. I don't know. I've never caught a pike. Admittedly, terrible at fishing. We've started taking our kids fishing in the summer, and I don't catch much.
No. We've only done it for one summer, and we've had... As a family, we've had some amount of success. You haven't.
That's what I said. I don't catch
but
much.
But it's fun. I mean, we go outside whenever we can. And our kids have, to varying degrees, like nature. But I think there's something about fish that's cool. It's something, and birds, and these two things that you can't really, like, control, right? You can't control their behavior. You can try and encourage it and lure them, but you can't control it. And so it's fun to watch kids try and interact with that dynamic.
Yeah. And of course, the first time we took our kids fishing, our oldest got spoiled. He threw his line in, literally the first time, and caught an enormous perch.
That broke the line.
It broke his fishing pole. And it wasn't like a kid pole. It was a legit pole. Snapped the pole in half. And we haven't been able to top that since.
Yeah, but Michigan is great for all of that. And the flooding, I mean, we were just up in that area. So we hope that it continues to recede and that people can get back to normal living up there.
Yeah. We got a great next hour lined up. We're going to be talking education, cars, and Waymo, and talking more of the news. Stay with us here on Paul W. Smith. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us here on Focus with Paul W. Smith. I'm Caitlin Buss.
I'm Kelly Cobb.
Yes, we are your hosts today. So a lot going on. Actually, we were kind of saying it's actually quiet. There's not a ton going on. So that's kind of interesting, except for a lot of the political stuff we were talking about earlier. But something that kind of continues to exist somewhat in the background here of the education landscape in Michigan, and of course, the State Board of Education picks, particular times to make their behavior known and take their action. But
behavior,
that I reported on, it was about a year ago, I think. So after the Big Beautiful Bill passed, this federal program was created to give tax credits up to about $1,700 per individual donor, a federal tax credit that could be given in exchange for a donation to an organization in Michigan, should Michigan opt in, that would allow parents, families, students to expand their educational options, whether it's public, private, homeschooling, you know, it could be tutoring, it could be transportation, it could be a number of things. It gives them more money. The state has not opted in yet. More than half the states already have. And it's been very quiet. Republican candidates have campaigned that they would opt into this program, but Whitmer has been completely silent on it. So in the background, the State Board of Education is about to take up a proposal completely opposing this. To join us and talk about this is someone I've worked with and really respect, Catherine Bussard. She also shares somewhat of my name, so I feel like we have a similarity. But she's the executive director and chief operating officer at Salt and Light Global. Catherine, are you there?
I am. Good okay. to be with you today.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. So first, if you could explain just quickly what Salt and Light Global does, but then take us into, you know, your work on this. You just had a piece today in the Detroit News on the State Board of Education's proposal. So fill us in.
Sure. So at Salt and Light Global, we really work to defend first liberties, and among those, certainly religious liberty, parental rights, and many other things, and just advocate for the cause of good governance so that future generations can know freedom and use that mm-hmm. to advance both the gospel and, again, continue this thing that we love in America of self-government. And so mm-hmm. we work really hard to preserve that. And in that article today, I really tried to look at that proposal from the State Board of Education and kind of debunk a couple misnomers that they're purporting about our state constitution, saying, oh, Michigan can't opt in. That's really not true at all. Mm-hmm. And then also come back and look at this through the constitutional lens of parental rights. It's important that government allows parents and respects the right of parents to direct and control the upbringing of their children. It really is mm-hmm. not the place of government to say, oh, the state is better equipped to make decisions for your child than you are. Mm-hmm. And that's really the attitude that we're finding from the State Board of Education and so many in Lansing when it comes to policies like this. I'll hand it back to you there.
Yeah. No, they've really tried to create it as a binary choice. So walk us through, you know, in your understanding, you know, the myth perhaps that they're taking public dollars or taking from the school aid fund and redistributing that to private schools or homeschools. Walk us through that a little bit.
So in a nutshell, what the One Beautiful Bill Act does is that it allows private individuals to donate to private nonprofit scholarship groups that have been vetted by the state government. We know they're licensed. We know they're legit. And
that's really all the state has to do with it is kind of get that going, right?
Exactly. Just like, you know, a church or a food pantry or any other nonprofit is licensed by the government and says, okay, we know you're official. When you donate to them, you can get a tax write-off for it. Well, this does that, and it allows a unique one-to-one tax write-off, so up to $1,700, like you said, per individual. However much an individual donates, you can deduct that amount off your federal taxes. And it's a federal law. And of course, federal law has supremacy over state law. And it's something that exists. It's out there. Other states, other students across the nation get to take advantage of this. Mm-hmm. And in Michigan, we have this clause in our Constitution. It's Article 8, Section 2. And basically, it prohibits public funding from being used to fund private education.
Right.
But what the Big Beautiful Bill does is that it allows private funding, private donations, mm-hmm. to go to private charities to fund private choices. And those private choices, I mean, you could use these for anything. You could say, you know what, I want a school choice to the public school the next district over, but because of my work schedule, I can't drive my kid there. Mm-hmm. So you could obtain affordable transportation through one of these scholarships to a different public school.
Right.
You could say my child that is in public school is dyslexic. They need some, you know, extra tutoring at the Dyslexia Institute, and I'm going to ask for a scholarship to pay for that mm-hmm. and keep your kid in public school. Or you could use it to fund, you know, homeschooling, private school. You could use it to fund, you know, maybe you have a public school student that's doing advanced coursework and they need some special technology tools. You could do anything with this, but what it does is it simply empowers parents using private dollars. And there's a huge difference because our state allows private dollars to be donated for any legitimate private cause. Mm-hmm. We only have this prohibition on education right. when it comes to public dollars, and these are not public dollars.
Right. It's curious. I mean, and you, I know your organization has also followed, you know, other things the state board has done recently. Mm-hmm. We both were part of kind of the health education standards. What did you think about how this is being done? And I had heard that there may be changes to the proposal that's being, you know, circulating right now. What do you think is coming?
It's tough to say. I think the bigger point that concerns me is from the health standards and interweaving this so that it was difficult for parents to know what's really being taught. Can I opt out? Mm-hmm. Just by muddying the waters, it makes it harder for parents to be engaged. And it felt like, I mean, when we went from 12 pages of standards to 71, it felt kind of like an intentional effort to obfuscate things. Mm-hmm. And with this, it feels like the state board is, you know, confusing things by saying, oh, our constitution can't do this. I know they have great legal counsel. I don't really think that it's that the state board members don't understand the difference between public and private. So I have to ask myself, you know, why are they doing this? Right. And it seems like they keep interposing the authority of the state and what they view as the just authority of the state to direct and control the upbringing of children instead of parents. Mm. And I think that's the thing that I would hope the public and voters think about before they vote in this next election is, you know, am I voting for someone that really believes parents can make good decisions for their children? Mm. Or do we need to relegate all power to the state? And when we do that, we find ourselves really just opening a can of worms. And I think that mentality is so pervasive at the state right now, minus a couple board members that seem to act independently.
Sure. Yeah. And so much of the frustration, I feel like, is about the process itself. You know, even there, mm-hmm. I don't believe, and maybe they will, but we'll have public comment before this is accepted or voted on as a resolution. So I know I don't want to speak for you, but they really need to listen to Michigan parents and you know, carry out that constitutional duty.
I couldn't agree more. And I think even just to put, you know, to put their actual job description first, can we get back to the business of helping kids learn instead of playing politics? You know, what are the policies that are going to help local schools and local school boards educate kids so we have an informed citizenry and skilled workforce in the future? That's really what their job is. And we don't need them weighing in on these federal national issues. Right. This belongs to the governor and the legislature.
Right. Thank you, Catherine. Always great to talk with you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too. God bless.
All right. Hang with us. We'll be back for more on Focus with Paul W. Smith. Hey, welcome back. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We're sitting in for Paul W. Smith. It's Caitlin Buss and
I'm Kelly Cobb.
Yeah. So we've been having fun. We've been talking about the economy, politics, education a little bit, and now we're going to bring on one of my favorite people, and not just because I talk to her more than I talk to almost anyone every day, but because she's a great editor at the Detroit News. She's a very interesting person, and she works really hard. I have to say that about her. So, Nicole Cook, are you there? Can we hear you?
Hi
Nicole. So
Hi,
Nicole's our opinion editor, and she has a huge job. She has to organize and keep track of everyone who wants their name in the Detroit News. But occasionally she gets to write, and I know she likes when she gets a little breath of fresh air. She has a column up today on Waymo, and you were in a Waymo recently.
Right, yeah.
So tell us about it. It was not in Detroit, but give us your experience.
It was recently on a trip to Atlanta. Waymo is now partnering with Uber. And so riders can actually pay for a ride in the Waymo.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, what stood out to me was kind of just how normal it felt. I mean, the car did everything it was supposed to do. It stayed in its lane. It followed all the laws. I mean, it got me there safely.
Yeah.
At one point, a person even stepped out in front of the car and it immediately braked. I mean, which... thank God, but
that had to be
beyond.
Like, and you had never been in anything like that before, right?
For sure, right. So it was a little nerve-wracking at first. I mean, I can't lie, but once I got in there and kind of got comfortable, I mean, it gives you the instructions, tells you exactly what's going on, who you can contact if something does go wrong. And I mean, it just felt safe. I mean, beyond a driving standpoint, I mean, it felt comfortable. I didn't have to kind of make awkward small talk with, you know, the Uber driver that you hop into the back of the car.
I don't do that. I just sit silently there, you know. Okay, but Nicole, so this is a self-driving vehicle,
right?
What's in the front driver's seat? Like, can you tell it you're late? Can it please drive a little faster? I mean, can you interact with it at all, you know?
And I guess that's...
Wait, you cut out. You cut out. Can you interact with it?
No.
Okay.
So you can. You can't interact with it. I mean, there's no one in the front seat. You're not even able to sit in the driver's seat. I mean, you can sit in the passenger seat and the seats in the back, but it follows all the laws. I mean, it doesn't go above the speed limit. So
I immediately don't like it.
I think Nicole's had to drive with me short distances. I don't know if she's ever had to do a long distance.
No, my drive was like 20 minutes, you know, so, and I wasn't running late.
So
yeah, well, she wrote a really interesting piece, and so now it's coming to Detroit. Do we know when that's going to be unveiled?
So they've been testing on Detroit roadways for the last year. I mean, but they've had I guess drivers in there testing.
Oh, okay.
So someone's just sitting there
driving
not doing
alone.
It.
No.
Right. Now,
but later on this year, Waymo, I mean, they haven't released an exact date or anything, but they do plan to do away with the test driver, and they will be just rolling around by themselves. So that's...
I just think that's going to be so weird when I look over and there are driverless cars on the road.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't... Atlanta and Detroit, I don't know how similar they are. We'll see.
People here, I mean, this is the Motor City. People, I feel like to, like, drive their car. Like, it's an experience to drive a car, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Nicole, okay, I got a question for you. So in your piece, you noted, I thought this was really interesting, 70% of people are skeptical of self-driving vehicles. So you're not skeptical of them anymore because you rode in one, correct? But were you to begin with? Like, where did you fall before and after?
Good question. I mean, I think it was nerve-wracking to me, but I just wanted to experience it. I'm just kind of a person that just likes to do the things, I guess. And so I was a little bit afraid. I was a little bit nervous. But once I got in there and saw that it was, you know, kind of nothing to it, it kind of changed my perspective a little bit.
Yeah. See, I'm of the mind, if it'd do things like, if there's someone slow driving in front of you, and you're just like, I don't want to be in behind this person anymore. Did it change lanes and go around people or anything like that? Or did it just kind of like ho-hum its way along, you know?
Well, yeah. So it did switch lanes. It does pass, you know, but it doesn't go above the whatever the speed limit is. So if it's 70, it's not going to go above 70.
So it doesn't know that Michigan's speed limit is actually 78. It's not aware of that. And you can't program that, basically.
Well, I'm sure the testers can. I mean, they've been
testing
on these
roadways.
Maybe
they'll make a Michigan version. They let the speed speedometer go up.
Yeah.
No, I think it's interesting. Nicole, and she pointed out a lot of the reasons people are concerned, which I probably put myself in that category. Not so much the impact on jobs. I think all the jobs are going away no matter what. But just, it's like a psychological shift that you have to get used to. So maybe I'll get there.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting to read your piece, Nicole. And maybe it's just a matter of, like, if everybody tries it, that's how we get that 70% number.
Yeah, I think I'm sure you're getting people thinking about it.
I mean, and just, I mean, people, it's new. People don't trust what they don't know. And so I think people are seeing these bad moments with these cars going viral, and that's all they're seeing. And I think that's shifting the public perception a lot quicker than all the good rides that are happening that aren't being, you know, recorded or reported on. So.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. Fun to talk with you, and thanks for your great work. You can check it out at DetroitNews.com/opinion.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me.
All right. Talk to you in a while. All right. We will be back soon with more Focus with Paul W. Smith.
Welcome back to Focus with Paul W. Smith. I'm Kelly Cobb.
There I am. I'm Caitlin Buss.
And we've been having a fun couple of hours here filling in for Paul. We don't know where he is. We can try and find out, but it's his business anyway. Yeah. So I hope he's having a good time. We wanted to come back to a couple of political stories that have been really interesting recently. And I think I want to start with the more controversial one because there's a lot of controversy on both sides. But there's news today that there is a recall effort against Dave Woodward, who is the chair of the Oakland County Commission. He runs effectively the legislature of Oakland County. Caitlin, he's our commissioner as well. And he's being recalled because at a prior meeting, what he did was, and this is a long line of stuff that the guy's done. At a prior meeting, he moved all the public comment to be after a vote is taken instead of when it's supposed to be, which is before, right? This is the democratic process.
I think I showed you that video.
You did. Yeah, you did. And people are in the audience. Like, what were they doing? Like, screaming at
him? Yeah. And he just kind of waved his arms in the air and shrugged it off.
Yeah. He doesn't care. he literally doesn't care about the, you know, for a Democrat, the democratic process here for the people of Oakland County to stand up and talk about issues. A lot of the stuff of the county that I've heard of is really in the dark, and he kind of rules with an iron fist. But this is a long line of sort of transgressions. That
well, Dave he didn't disclose his business arrangement with Sheetz,
with Sheetz.
Yeah, but when that was under consideration.
So he's got Sheetz as a private
client. And then voted against the ethics proposal brought forward after that.
Right.
So yeah, he doesn't care.
He's getting paid by Sheetz. And he says, well, we're not voting at Sheetz at the commission level, but he has sway with so many city officials in all the different towns in Oakland County. He actually runs their campaigns out of another company. So he has ties to all of these local governments that are deciding this, and he didn't disclose it. Then he pushes against ethics reforms. More recently, he took a trip. This just came out. He took a trip to a drone company headquarters. They paid for this vacation effectively to see their headquarters for him. He never disclosed the trip. He never disclosed anything about it whatsoever. And then he comes back and he pushes forward to basically hire the drone company. Mm. This clear conflict of interest problem. And he just doesn't care about this one. The Sheetz one is another one. There's another one where, and this story was, I don't remember the Up North Resort story. That may have been a few months ago. His family owns a resort up north. And you know, that's fine. Great. Good for him. That's wonderful. I wish everybody could own a little place up north. But he refused to disclose the financial relationship that he has with that business. So he just consistently is saying no to disclosure, no to FOIA requests. That's another complaint that a lot of other commissioners have had. He's not a transparent guy, and he rules with an iron fist. And, you know,
I hope when I don't know what that looks like at that level, a recall petition.
They got to get, I think, like 9,000 signatures. And then he goes on the ballot and then with somebody else. Hmm. And so they put him up against each other.
I mean, Oakland County, and we both grew up in Oakland County and now live in Oakland County. So we've seen a real difference in how it's run in a lot of things, and not all of it for the worst. There's a lot of good things that have happened, but certainly the management and the city government has been, or I'm sorry, the county government has been lackluster. So I hope they're successful. I mean, I think he's proven that he does not want to be transparent. So much of politics, you know, it's just, what do you think is going to happen when you stare down a room of people screaming at you and tell them that they can't speak?
And he basically said he didn't care.
Shifting
gears really quick, we only got a couple of minutes left, but there's a lot of hubbaloo, whatever the word would be, about the gubernatorial race right now. You've got a surge in, theoretically, a surge in the numbers behind Perry Johnson after he spent $15 million of his own money to put himself on the ballot. A big support coming out. So a new poll is out putting him up, pretty high against against John James, who has historically held like 40-50% of the electorate of the Republican ticket. Mm-hmm. John James responding to this with their own poll that says, no. We're actually winning. And this is a poll that James put out over basically the same time period, showing James up 41% with Perry Johnson only at 18%.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, ask me for a fact and I'll give you the one that I want, you know, kind of thing. I mean,
I think obviously the truth's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
And my gut is that Perry has moved up and that John has moved down and that they're relatively neck and neck. I think they both kind of exhausted what they have. So John has kind of exhausted the extent of his name ID, and Perry has probably not exhausted his money, but perhaps exhausted how far his money can go. You know, I think that big boost was about what that money can buy, and it would take another splash, but you don't have the timing of the first splash to work with. So he's kind of peaked, I would say, and they're probably neck and neck. The frustrating thing for me, I think, is that there's so many qualified candidates who are really great. I mean, Tom Leonard is running a really issues-focused, on-the-ground campaign. I mean, just from his social media and from talking to him, he's very busy. Eric put out a new ad buy that was really, you know, entertaining and trying to elevate his name ID. And Mike Cox has run a good campaign, too. And he has, for someone who left the public eye, really come back in a strong way. So I would love to see some of those people break through on polling. It just seems like it's on a lock up there at the top of the Republican ticket. And then, of course, what that means, because it's a three-way race no matter what. So Democrats and Duggan have had this huge advantage. Everyone's been talking about Benson. They've been talking about Duggan. Republicans have been mucking around.
Yep.
And we'll see where that lands.
Yeah. I think the most fascinating thing, too, on this is the largest vote share goes to undecided in all
well,
of
that,
these
yes,
polls.
Well, that, yes. And that's, I don't know. There's my next column. Because really, that will determine everything. You're right.
Yeah, it's who can sell it. And there's a long way until November, so we'll get there.
But the filing, at least, I think this is about the filing deadline. So
yeah. Well, we've had a lot of fun today. I'm Kelly Cobb. Thanks for sitting in with us.
Yeah, and I'm Caitlin Buss of the Detroit News, and we really appreciate your time today. Thanks, Paul, for letting us sit in for you. And listen in tomorrow on Focus with Paul W. Smith here on WJR Radio.